It's a different lifestyle, being a railroader and being a train conductor. So especially starting out, you know, that train conductor is going to be someone who's on call 6 days a week, and then they're off 2 days a week. But when they're available for those 6 days, they're on call 24/7. It's obviously outdoors too. You know, trains don't operate inside. So people who can be successful working outside, working in the elements, when they're, especially when they're challenging, you know, that starts to sound a lot like a train conductor.
The concept of working on the railroad was so popular at one time in the United States of America that it was immortalized in song. But what does it mean today? This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today, we're taking a peek inside of the modern rail industry with a representative from one of the biggest railroads in the country.
I'm Brad Dodd, the Director of Talent Acquisition for Norfolk Southern Railroad.
So, Brad, you try to get people to go work on the railroad, as they say. Is that hard to do nowadays? Is there any kind of shortage in people work in the railroad industry?
It definitely doesn't come without its challenges, especially in a labor market that's really still at some unprecedented unemployment rates. Certain jobs are a little bit more challenging than others, and train conductors is by far our highest volume job. We'll actually hire on any given year really a couple thousand different train conductors, and we have 100 different rail yards across 22 states, and so some will get maybe 5 or 10, but others will need 50 and 75, and so being strategic about where we're putting our efforts and where we're competing in different labor markets, different towns, can certainly be a challenge for us at times.
So what does it mean to be a train conductor in the 21st century? Because it's a job I think a lot of people almost have a nostalgic understanding of what that means. What does the modern train conductor do? What's that job like?
Yeah, the nostalgia, there's kind of a piece of Americana about being a railroader and being a train conductor. You know, and the job today is, it has its similarities and differences than it does from, you know, 100 years ago. And so we've been around 195 years, and there's aspects of a train conductor that's identical to what it was 195 years ago, where we're moving freight from A to B. We're an industry and a job that's really, you know, vital to this country's economy to make sure products are on store shelves, there's gasoline or electricity for your car or your home. Essential to the national security of this country. What's changed over time and what a conductor's job has continued to evolve into is being one that uses a lot more technology in its day-to-day. You can obviously imagine 195 years ago, there weren't computers and cell phones. And today on a locomotive, there's those things, and a train conductor is going to have a mobile train device that's mirrored just after a cell phone. Much like a FedEx worker or a UPS delivery driver, when they come up and they scan your package and you sign for it, you know, very similar technology is going into railroading today and what a train conductor's day-to-day responsibilities are.
What are some of those day-to-day responsibilities? What's the conductor do?
Yeah. So the conductor, in contrast to the locomotive engineer, the conductor is going to be the person who is boots on the ground. They're going to be the individuals uncoupling rail cars, coupling rail cars, climbing up and down rail cars to operate handbrakes. They're going to make sure that rail cars are delivered in the exact location at customer facilities, or they're pulled out of customer facilities safely. They're going to make sure that they understand all the traffic restrictions or the speed limits while that train's going up and down the tracks, and communicate and work with their engineer counterpart so everyone knows, you know, any speed restrictions or track impediments that may be ahead for them to look out for and make sure they're operating appropriately.
So what kind of person thrives in this kind of job, and what kind of skills does somebody need going into it?
Yeah, so and thrive's a word we use a lot out here. It's a different lifestyle, being a railroader and being a train conductor. They're a union job, and so they're governed a lot by union seniority. And so especially starting out, you know, that train conductor is going to be someone who's on call 6 days a week, and then they're off 2 days a week. But when they're available for those 6 days, they're on call 24/7. So that may mean they're going to get called into work at 2 a.m. or on a Saturday or a holiday even. And so individuals who can be successful in a very non-traditional lifestyle, who can be a bit flexible in when they can go to work and times they get called into work. It's obviously outdoors too. You know, trains don't operate inside. So people who can be successful working outside, working in the elements, when they're, especially when they're challenging, you know, that starts to sound a lot like a train conductor. And most importantly, someone who can work safely. You know, we have a good list of our kind of standard operating procedures or safety rules that our employees have to be able to adhere to and follow to make sure that they're keeping themselves and their peers, the communities, and the equipment safe. You know, people who become train conductors, A to Z. We really take individuals from just such varied backgrounds, varied experiences. And a lot of that has to do with is we train people from the ground up. We have about a 4 or 5 month training program that train conductors will start off in McDonough, Georgia. They'll spend 3 weeks down there kind of going through a conductor boot camp, if you will, and then they'll come back to their work location and continue training for 4, 5, 6 months until we feel like they're ready to be off on their own. And so we'll take people from just those varied backgrounds. You know, if they can be successful in the lifestyle and the work environment of outdoors, we'll train them on how to be a conductor. So there's no special certifications or experiences that we're looking for in order to bring someone on and give them a chance to be successful.
So in a similar type of job, but a similar industry, transportation, there have been recent upticks in CDL licensed truck drivers for females, and there's a little bit more diversity in that field than there used to be. Is that an issue with the rail industry? Is it getting more diverse, or are you seeking more diversity in that industry?
We are. It is a challenge, and much like the trucking industry, and it's an area where we continue to try to find outlets and avenues where we can improve on our representation and make this more of a accommodating job. There's aspects that aren't unfortunately going to change, like the on-call schedules at times, working nights and working holidays. And so that makes it tough for anyone to come out into this role, you know, especially women who may be the primary caregivers or the household caregivers. We very much are able to hire women out here, and those who can be successful, we try to empower them, champion them, go to them for resources, opinions on how we can better recruit and better bring on women into this role to increase that representation. It's not for everyone, male or female apart. It's unfortunately not for everyone, but it's something that we continue to try to seek outlets for in order to build onto our diversity.
Well, something that we've seen that's a little bit similar in transportation with trucking is that there is a little bit of an aging out problem too. Is that the case in the railway industry, that you might be looking at a long-term worker shortage gap because we haven't seen as many people getting into those fields as maybe we did 20 years ago?
You know, it's a good question, and we definitely think about the railroad isn't that type of employment that people think of, maybe that they did 20, 30 years ago. You know, back generations ago, I think people would be more apt to tell you that if you could get on a job with a railroad, you were set for life. And a lot of those aspects remain true today. But the branding and the perception of the railroad has probably changed over time as you've seen technology and new industries come online, that the transportation industry has maybe taken a bit of a backseat to those. So it's definitely part of our job to get out there and make sure that we're bringing awareness to the transportation industry. At the end of the day, no matter what global economy we may be in, goods are going to have to ship from A to B. And the transportation industry and the railroad industry is a vital part of that industry, is a vital part of that equation, and will remain a vital part of that equation. The economies of scale for railroading are one that trucks have a hard time competing with. You know, we can move over 200 containers on a single train, and being able to transport that type of volume efficiently and a speed that really competes with trucks, you know, is going to continue to have the railroads viable generation over generation going forward.
So what are some of the things that people don't know about this kind of job and about the industry in general?
The railroad industry, the AAR, American Association of Railroads, puts out a great data point that railroads and the rail industry is really one of the most competitive paying industries out there. I believe their number is around 95, 96 percentile of all industries. And, you know, whether you're a train conductor or a train dispatcher or, you know, at the corporate headquarters, these are really, really stable jobs, moving freight, like I said earlier, from A to B, the economies of scale. When we see, you know, layoffs in the job market and tech sector layoffs, we kind of look internally at the railroad and go, we're always hiring. And we may be hiring in different volumes, but we're usually always hiring. And so these jobs that we're able to provide are really, you know, vital to this country's economy. They're well-paying jobs, great benefits. You know, I'll tell you one of the often underappreciated and overlooked benefits of being a railroader is we don't pay Social Security. Railroads and Norfolk Southern and other railroads are actually exempt from Social Security, and there's a neat little history story behind it to when the railroads were, you know, continuing to develop their footprint across the country in the early 1900s. They saw this need to really take care of their employees and their employees' families after, you know, their working careers were done. And so the railroads, before FDR's New Deal, the railroads came out with their own version of Social Security, which is a federal government program, just like Social Security. But obviously, it's only for railroaders. And so when FDR came out with the Social Security program and the New Deal, we are legally written in as an exemption to the Social Security law. And the maybe the best fact about what we have in railroad and railroad retirement is it pays out twice as much as Social Security. So anytime we see in the news maybe that there's a, you know, rates got to go up or it's underfunded and going to go away by year 2030, we feel pretty good over at the railroad and what we have going on. We're still able to offer a pension. You know, few companies can offer a pension today. We still have a lifetime pension as well as a 401k. So being a railroader can be kind of lucrative in the short term and very lucrative in the long term as well. And so we just like to get out, telling our story, bringing some awareness to people about the opportunities that we have and how we can support them. I'll just add, especially for, you know, the industry in general, we move everything. If you can conceptually think of it, we either move the finished product or the raw goods that go into the finished product. You know, railroads are apt to move stuff long haul. We compete with trucks, but trucks are actually our customer too, in a way. And so we'll move a good, you know, 500 miles across country, and then we'll hand it off to a truck to deliver it that last 5 or 10 miles, because not every customer of ours is butted up right against a railroad track. Some of our customers are some of the biggest brand name blue chip companies you've heard of, including the UPSs of the world and the Amazons of the world, but also oil and gas and farming companies like ADM, one of our largest customers out here in the central Illinois area.
What is the breadth of the operations for Norfolk Southern? How regional is it? There are, if anybody's played Monopoly, there's so many railroads.
And so all of those railroads still exist today just through mergers and acquisitions into other railroads. Some of those railroads exist at Norfolk Southern Railroad. And really, in the United States, there's 4 major U.S. railroads, 2 out west, which are going to be Union Pacific and the BNSF. BNSF is Warren Buffett's railroad, their private company. And then all east, you have the CSX Railroad and, of course, Norfolk Southern. So for the most part, our territories don't overlap, especially east to west. And so even with that, we have to work together. All the railroads combined, we have to work together because we can only take freight so far, in which we may have to hand it off to CSX or we may have to hand it off to a West Coast railroad to continue going out to California. And so we all, while we compete against each other, we all actually have to work with each other as well, share locomotives and make sure rail cars get passed off efficiently and effectively. At Norfolk Southern, our system is 22 states on the eastern half of the country. And so we'll go, you know, southwest down to New Orleans, all the way out west to Kansas City, Chicago, and then going back east, we'll be all the way east up to Buffalo and New York City and down southeast towards Jacksonville. And kind of everything in between that is where we operate. And so we have a pretty large footprint that covers the majority of the country's population that we have to serve.
How long of a run does a train typically have? Does it typically go across a good chunk of that at any given time? How often are people getting switched out?
Yeah.
And what does that mean for the employees?
Yeah, so a train itself will typically go hundreds and hundreds of miles across many states. And so if you think about a train that's going to go from Chicago, Illinois to New York City, essentially, that train's going to travel quite a few hundreds of miles, and it's going to stop and change crews about every 200 to 300 miles. And so we're regulated by the federal government and the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA, and much like truck drivers and air traffic controllers, there's a certain number of hours our employees are allowed to work before they have to stop and get some rest before fatigue might set in and it starts to become unsafe. And so that limit will be about 12 hours. And so they'll take trains to designated points, stop, and a new crew will get on and continue that train moving. And our trains are, when they're moving at top speed, they're typically moving around 55, 60 miles per hour. So overall, we feel good and we're able to compete with that truck-like market. We offer a truck-like service, you know, going essentially highway speeds up and down the railroad.
So how long do the crews have to be off? I'm sure it's just like the airline industry where you have to be off so many hours before you can go back to work again. And what happens? Do you just wait for another train that needs a crew to come on, just like an airline? Or how does that work for the employees?
So crews, a person has to be off at least 10 hours once they put off duty. They have 10 hours of what we call undisturbed rest. We can't call them to work or call them and ask them a question. That's their designated time to get some rest, get some sleep, and be ready to get called back into work after that 10 hours. And so it's on us as a railroad to make sure logistically we're planning our people out appropriately, planning our train schedules out appropriately. So when a train stops, there's a crew there ready to go to continue it moving versus a train stop. And we say we still got 3 or 4 hours before the next crew is ready to continue that train moving on. So we work a lot with our logistics team and supply chain team to make sure that our schedules are such that there's minimal to no downtime to get a train across country.
Sounds like those logistics can be complicated too. One person on a crew or a couple people on a crew might get sick. That's when you have to call somebody else in to join that crew, that sort of thing. Is that something that is often a problem?
It can cause problems. We carry essentially extra conductors, and if other industries have things called extra boards, and so do we. And so if a train conductor calls out sick who would have been scheduled to get called into work at 10 p.m., there's a list of extra board train conductors who are available 24/7 who step up and take that person's place. And so all going well, we have a good number of extra board train conductors and locomotive engineers for when people call off sick and also take their vacation and take their personal days as well, so we can continue to make sure that we have our freight covered. And one great benefit about those extra employees is while they may be deemed extra and not work 5 days a week, they have what we call a guaranteed minimum earnings. And so as long as they're available and not calling out sick themselves, if they work, say, 2 days a week and their compensation isn't great for those 2 days, we're going to bump them up to a guaranteed minimum earning level in order to make sure that they're well compensated, even though they didn't maybe work a full 4 or 5 days a week. And so benefits like that can be a little unique to the railroad, kind of help us maintain a workforce that can continue to earn money even in slower weeks or slower months if we're not moving as much freight as we thought we would or didn't have as big of a need of an extra board as we thought we would.
Typically, is there a lot of cross-training that happens in these sorts of jobs? Do people start out as a conductor and, say, move into another job? I mean, like you said, it sounds like it can be kind of physically demanding. So I think as people might get older, they're like, I don't want to work outside as much. I want to move into a different thing, maybe advance to more training, different type of job, maybe higher pay. Do you have a lot of internal advancement, or are these things where people have different specialties and they're coming in from different?
A little bit of both. And by design, there's definitely internal advancement for a train conductor specifically, where after a certain number of years, that individual is going to promote to a locomotive engineer. And so one unique thing about railroading in Norfolk Southern is we don't hire locomotive engineers and train people to be one. We look at our train conductor population, and through union seniority, when someone's the senior most conductor in the union, they're the next person to become a locomotive engineer. And so they'll take that promotion to become a locomotive engineer, which becomes a six-figure job, a well-paying job. And it's a little less physically demanding as well as someone who's inside the locomotive, not boots on the ground, sitting down operating the locomotive forwards and backwards. Aside from that, there's also some additional advancement opportunities that people can apply for. And, after they've maybe continued their education or shown that they are, kind of very good, especially in that supply chain space. And so a lot of our transportation supervisors are former conductors and engineers who have decided to go into management, jobs that are not union-based jobs. Some of our highest kind of ranking transportation supervisors were men and women who started as train conductors, showed that they had that skill set to become a supervisor and go into management, and they've been excelling for decades, really. There's also this opportunity for people to look into different, maybe mechanical-type crafts. Those become a little bit more of a challenge just because those are different unions. And they often means, resetting your seniority, which can become a challenge for maybe for someone who's got 10 years into the railroad and say, I have to start my seniority all over again if I want to go to a different union type of mechanical craft or electrical kind of craft.
So this is probably the most important thing I have to ask you out of everything we talked about here today. When I'm stuck at, a crossing, For a long time, whose fault is it?
It can be a number of things. The best advice I'll give you is if the train is not moving, I wouldn't wait on the train. I would unfortunately go find a different path around. If the train is moving and keeps on moving, then obviously it'll be clear and hopefully a short amount of time. You know, sometimes it could be, you know, there's an incident ahead, and with trains consistently moving across 22 states and at any given time we have 400 or 500 trains across our system, you know, things can back up if maybe there's a derailment. And obviously when we stop a train, we very much try to intentionally not stop it on things like railroad crossings. But the way that the railroads grew up, especially out, you know, west away from population centers in the early 1900s or late 1800s, and then towns kind of grew up around the railroads, there's a few locations, unfortunately, on our system where it's just logistically hasn't been grown up conducive to a train having to take a quick pause and maybe not block a few railroad crossings, unfortunately.
See, I thought as an employee of Norfolk Southern, when I asked you whose fault it was, you would just tell me Amtrak.
We play nicely with Amtrak. While they use our railroad tracks to move their passenger trains from A to B, we try to give them priority. We try to make sure that they have a kind of first come, first serve when it comes to routes through our network to make sure that the general public and Amtrak passengers are having a good railroad experience overall. And we certainly don't want to be Norfolk Southern diminishing that experience.
That raises a question, though. I always thought it was very amazing, you know, when you look at there's a lot you don't see as a passenger. There's a lot you don't see driving when you see the tracks. But those logistics involve different vehicles moving at different speeds and different track patterns, I would imagine. Is everything plotted out kind of like with an airplane, how they have to have their flight plan? Do the engineers have to have a kind of a flight plan for their trip, at least from one area to another?
They do. There are a lot of similarities, really, between airlines and airline logistics and train logistics. And so you nailed it when you said certain trains can go certain speeds. Obviously, a freight train that we operate here at Norfolk Southern, even if it can go 60 miles an hour, it still takes a long time for that train to get up to speed, to go from 0 to 60, which is very different from an Amtrak train that can go from 0 to 60 and really very quickly compared to the railroad. And so we have a train dispatching center in Atlanta, Georgia, where our company headquarters is at. That's very much like air traffic control. When they're plotting out what trains are going, what speed, how heavy trains are, is it 5,000 tons or is it 15,000 tons? And so how fast is it going to take for that train to get up to track speed? What's coming? Then there's train priorities too, because when we're moving container traffic or, you know, UPS or the mail for the government, that's going to have to move a little bit faster than, say, maybe a coal train that has, you know, a day or two to get to its final destination. And so prioritizing, understanding train dynamics all goes into that equation.
Well, Brad, thanks for coming in today and talking about the railroad industry and for visiting the college and talking to our students as well about the opportunities that they might find out there.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Brad Dodd is a director of talent acquisition at Norfolk Southern. He spoke with Heartland Community College students about careers in the rail industry and does outreach to young people about the jobs available at his company. If you're interested in other podcast interviews about transportation, history, or other topics, subscribe to Random Acts of Knowledge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening.